You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
Sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, April 19th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live from the Wynn Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada. Nevada. That state that begins with an N, where Las Vegas is where we are broadcasting from. I am at the Mass Torts Conference in Las Vegas, one of whom the organizers is Mike Papantonio, my co-host on Ring of Fire. And on the program today, we're going to be talking to Ari Berman of The Nation magazine via phone. Also, later in the program, I'm going to be talking to attorney James Kaufman from 11 Papantonio about the Jobs Act. Well, that's weird, Sam. Why are you talking to a tort attorney on the Jobs Act? Because this is the guy who's going to come in and try and sue those companies that rip off their investors, which apparently is going to be fairly inevitable upon the passage of the Jobs Act. We'll talk to him more about that as the program goes on. I'm going to be here tomorrow as well. Cliff Schechter in the house. We'll be talking to Cliff Schechter. And also tomorrow on the program, I've got, and I can't say much about it because the story has not been released, but one of the attorneys here sits on the plaintiff committee, steering committee, of plaintiffs in the BP Gulf oil spill settlement. And apparently the terms of the settlement are coming out. And we're going to sit down and talk to one of the attorneys who has been instrumental in fashioning this. And not a moment too soon. I'm looking at a story. I'll probably talk about it tomorrow, but I'll just give you the headline. It's from Al Jazeera, Adar Jamil. Gulf seafood deformities alarm scientists. I'm not a scientist, but I'm not terribly excited at seafood that has been deformed by chemicals as a consumer. And as somebody who cares about the sustainability of our ecosystem in this world. So, at the very least, we're hopefully looking at the settlement as at least not leaving the people of the Gulf in the same situation that people were left in the wake of the Exxon Valdez. And hopefully, over the course of the next day or so, Bobby Kennedy's here. He's going to be speaking to the conference. He also an attorney, and one of the reasons, aside from the fact that I love to come to Las Vegas because I love to lose my own money, but the other reason why I come to this conference, because, you know, of course, it's a good time for me to spend with the people who also produce Ring of Fire. But tort attorneys are essentially the last vestige, the last refuge for those of us who are looking for any type of protection from corporations, either consumers or workers. And particularly at a time where we have seen the regulatory agencies of our government be corrupted by corporate interests. And particularly at a time where we see Congress doing its best to roll back environmental protections, roll back labor protections, roll back consumer protections. And so, frankly, the last vestige of protection that we have come from tort attorneys. Now, you know, there's tort attorneys and then there's tort attorneys. And certainly one of the things that we've discussed on this program in the past is that, you know, I think it was a conversation I had with Fran Lebowitz about when attorneys started to advertise as being sort of one of the bellwethers or milestones showing the sort of degradation of professions. And certainly in the context of every profession, there are people on one end of it or another that are less or more inclined to perceive what they do as central to the fabric of society or maintaining it. And certainly within the legal profession, that's a big issue. And so, there's some really fascinating people here and who are doing very interesting stuff. And so it also gives me a great opportunity to sit at a blackjack table, watch my money melt away, and have securities lawyers explain to me issues that, you know, you need to be talking to someone. You either need to take a course or you can sit down with them at a blackjack table and find out about it. And so it's a great opportunity for me. But in the meantime, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to Ari Berman of The Nation. Hopefully on the phone, I have Ari Berman from The Nation. Ari, are you there?
Hey, Sam, I'm here.
Oh, my gosh. That works so perfectly, Ari. I'm shocked.
I think, isn't technical difficulty just built in as a prerequisite for liberal radio?
Yes, that is. That is, in fact, the case. But that's my point, is that's what's so shocking about this. You sound great. I was able to get you on. I'm just completely shocked.
Always a pleasure to be here, and I can only imagine what you're doing in Vegas right now.
Yeah, well, right. You know, and I'm going to – usually Friday is Name Drop Friday, and so I'll save the full details of the story. But I can tell you, I was – when I landed here, I went very quickly to the tables. I was doing very well. And then I'm heading – literally heading back to the elevator at about like 11:30 at night, local time. And I run into David Cross and Will Arnett, old friends of mine who are here for the National Association of Broadcasting. And then everything fell away for me. I had a lot of problems after that.
You took mushrooms and ended up at Cirque du Soleil.
That's right.
Yeah.
Let me just – the easy way of saying this is – 30 hours later, I was naked in the fetal position in the corner of a casino. I don't know which casino it was, and somehow I made my way back to the hotel room.
That sounds great.
Yeah. Now, Ari, from the...
That's an awkward transition.
Yes. No, of course. No, but my audience appreciates that I can transition both from the Bachelor movie or whatever that is. What was the name of that movie? Bachelor?
No, it was Knocked Up where that happened.
No. What's the movie in Vegas? The Bachelor Party.
Oh,
Bachelor Party.
No, The Hangover.
The Hangover. That's all right. There you go. All right. So that concludes the entertainment section of our program today, or at least the entertainment-oriented section of our program today, and not to imply that you're not entertaining. You always are, Ari.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
So you got a piece in The Nation, Why the Supreme Court Matters. This has been an extensive topic of mine on this show in the context of the importance of the election coming up, but in general, talk to me about this.
Well, I think the stakes in the court have never really been higher, because you look at not only the Citizens United decision in 2010, which was such a radical departure from past precedent, then you have the health care law that's come before the court and will be decided in June. But then the real reason I wanted to write this article was all the other cases that are coming before the court in the next year or two. And it's really kind of stunning how many hot button issues are coming before the court. We have Arizona's immigration law is going to be argued next week. In October, when the fall term for the court starts, we're going to have a challenge to affirmative action. Then shortly thereafter, there's a bunch of other big issues that are coming before the court. Most likely gay marriage will come before the court, either through Proposition 8 or the Defense of Marriage Act. Most likely a challenge to the Voting Rights Act will come before the court. There's going to be perhaps a replay of the Citizens United argument because Montana has a ban on corporate campaign contributions.
Wasn't that just accepted by the court just like 2 or 3 days ago?
What, that they were going to hear it?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure they're going to hear it, but I don't know the exact details of it.
Okay.
And then we also have some other things, for example, the indefinite detention of enemy combatants at places like Guantanamo, whether they can actually challenge those detentions, and the possibility, in fact, that we could even hear a challenge to Roe v. Wade, given all the new anti-abortion restrictions passed since the 2010 election by Republicans. So we have a situation now where all these important cases where regarding key rights for minorities, immigrants, women, gays and lesbians, disenfranchised voters, those are all coming before the court in the next year or two.
There's also, I imagine, a host of cases that are coming to the courts that are sort of far less sexy in some respects, but have incredible implications in terms of the way that our society is structured financially and in terms of corporate rights and whatnot, that people like you and I don't tend to discuss that much. And in fact, maybe on this court, you know, those are part of the reason why people like you and I don't tend to discuss much or have much awareness of, is because those are the places where there's no 5-4 split, that sadly the court has moved so far to the right in so many respects over the past 30, 40 years that even the so-called liberals line up in those situations.
Well, I do think there is a very real difference between the quote-unquote liberals on the court and the quote-unquote conservatives on the court. But it is important to remember that the liberals on the court are basically moderates these days. whereas the conservatives on the court are very, very conservative. Of the 10 most conservative justices from 1937 to 2006, five of them are serving today. Clarence Thomas is the most conservative. Antonin Scalia is number three. John Roberts is number four. Sam Alito is number five. And I think most disturbing is Anthony Kennedy, who is supposed to be the swing vote on the court, is the 10th most conservative justice since the 1930s. So I think that really puts in perspective how far right the court has moved. And so, yes, there are decisions where they're 6-3 or 7-2, whereas in the past, those would not have been Supreme Court rulings. But there's also just a lot of decisions that are 5-4 decisions that are very conservative in nature, such as the Citizens United decision. And that's why I think the court's really important in the 2012 election, because the next president will probably get an opportunity to either shore up the left or the right flank of the court, or perhaps even tip the balance of power. And if the court became 6-3 conservative under Romney or 5-4 sort of moderate under Obama, that's a pretty big difference.
Yeah, I mean, you start your piece off by saying that in 75, John Paul Stevens was nominated by Gerald Ford. At the time, he occupied the ideological center of the Supreme Court. By the time he retired in 2010, he was the court's most liberal member. And really, I mean, he was replaced by Kagan, or was it Kagan or Sotomayor that replaced Stevens?
I think it was Kagan.
And
it was Kagan.
And so we're talking that here's a guy. He still would be the most liberal a member of the court at this point, because Kagan, I think, is already shown to a certain extent that she's to the right of Stevens in a couple of areas. I mean, so this is fairly stunning, where the center of the court in 1975 is now not even represented on the court, has dropped off the left margin.
Yeah, and Stevens himself said that every member of the court since 75 has been replaced by someone who was more conservative than their predecessor. So the liberals on the court are replaced by people that are less liberal than themselves. You get, for example, from Stevens to Kagan. And then not only that, but the conservatives are replaced always by someone who is more conservative than the predecessor. So you have a shift, for example, the big shift on the court was from Sandra Day O'Connor, who was a relative moderate, to Sam Alito. And that's a very big deal. And that gave us, for example, the Citizens United decision. And I think on a lot of these social issues that are coming before the court, O'Connor may have had a moderating influence that does not exist to this day. I don't want to glorify O'Connor because she was part of Bush v. Gore and a lot of other bad decisions. But just from any sort of standpoint, the justices on the court who are from the right are more conservative than she was. And even if Obama's able to make a choice to replace Ginsburg, it's going to be tough for him to even find someone who is as liberal as Ginsburg is. I mean, just to put it in perspective, when I mentioned those top 10 most conservative members of the court from 37 to 2006, there's only one member of the current court who makes the most liberal list, and that's Justice Ginsburg at number 10. So to put that in perspective, Kennedy's number 10 on the conservative list, Ginsburg is number 10 on the liberal list, but she's the most liberal member of the bench, whereas he's the swing vote. And so I think that just goes to show you how conservative the court is.
Well, let's talk about the idea that the I don't want to mix metaphors here, but the bench for the bench, the Supreme Court bench, is pretty thin, in part because President Obama seems to have not taken filling the federal judiciary as seriously as he should. Now, that's not to imply that there's not been a tremendous amount of Republican obstruction. There has, but there hasn't been a concerted effort to fill these vacancies, has there?
No, the Obama administration really dropped the ball on this. It wasn't a priority for them. A lot of their top advisors came from the House of Representatives, most namely Rahm Emanuel, so they weren't that familiar with judges to begin with, and they didn't think it was a priority. Rahm told people on numerous occasions that judges don't matter or that the left didn't care about judges and the administration shouldn't pick a fight over it, which is kind of odd considering you appoint judges for life. So if anything matters, it's people that are appointed for life. And so what's happened as a result is we have a record high 80 vacancies on the federal bench now. There's been 80 vacancies for over 1,000 days, which is really, really stunning. stunning. Obama has appointed 45 fewer justices than Bill Clinton and 36 fewer than George W. Bush during the same tenure of their presidency. This is judges to the federal bench. Obama's nominees have waited five times as long as Bush's to be confirmed. And not only that, the justices that have been confirmed have been older and relatively moderate, as opposed to the judges that Bush put on the court were younger and much more conservative. And so the Obama administration has really done very little to either fight the obstructionism in the Senate or to remake the judiciary more broadly in his own image, whatever that image might be. And so this is really one of the key differences, I think, between the Bush administration and the Obama administration. Bush basically got a third of all federal judges appointed to the court, which is really, really stunning. Obama could actually leave office if he loses in 2012 with more vacancies than when he entered, which I think is really, really surprising. And if there's anything Obama should try to be doing in his last days in office, if indeed these are his last months in office, is to try to fill these judicial vacancies. Otherwise, Republicans are going to come in, they're going to change the Supreme Court, and they're also going to be able to push the federal judiciary even further and further to the right.
And it's the federal judiciary that obviously handles the vast majority of the cases, in addition to providing the being sort of the minor leagues, if you will, for the Supreme Court, a selection pool. It handles a huge amount of casework that never rises to the Supreme Court. Well, let me ask
a tiny fraction of cases get before the Supreme Court. So the federal judiciary is incredibly important, even though none of us can name virtually any judges. They're incredibly powerful people in American politics.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that for the most part, the judges that I can name are conservative. And so, you know, you have this quote from Pam Carlin in your piece, who is, I've literally been trying to get her to come on my program for like 2 years. One of my favorite.
You put in a good word, Sam.
Yes, I do. But she's got that quote about Rahm Emanuel kept telling people that the left doesn't care about judges and the base wouldn't punish Obama for not filling judicial vacancies. And I can't imagine anything more correct.
Well, to an extent, he was true. Well, I think Rahm said one thing that was true and one thing wasn't. One thing he said, which I didn't put in the article, was that that judges weren't important, which we obviously know is not the case. But the second thing he said, which is the left hasn't punished Obama for not filling the vacancies, is true.
Absolutely.
And I think, yeah, and I think that just speaks to the fact that there is no federalist society on the left like there is on the right. The left is not conditioned to care about these issues in the way that right does. The right has been railing against the Supreme Court in particular since Brown versus Board of Education and particularly since Roe v. Wade. So there's a 40-year history here of conservatives mobilizing specifically against the court and liberals really looking to the court as their defenders of their rights, particularly on social issues. I think that's starting to change now with the Citizens United decision. I do think that, generally speaking, progressives are much more aware of the court than they were before and much more angry at it because of that decision. But it hasn't reached critical mass where even now you don't see a lot of people on the left saying to the president, you know, you need to commit to repealing Citizens United. You need to talk about it. Quite the contrary, Obama's actually backsliding on Citizens United by forming his own super PAC and taking a lot of unlimited money. And so this idea that there's a reform agenda for the court in the Democratic Party or in the progressive movement, there really isn't. It's been largely absent.
There's the American Constitutional Society, I guess, which is sort of the left's sort of late entry attempt to sort of build something similar to the Federalist Society. Is it basically that the left just was lulled into 50 years worth of, or 30 or 40 years worth of the Supreme Court sort of functioning in a more moderate or left way over these years? I mean, what accounts for the fact that the left doesn't seem to care? I mean, you know, one would think that Bush v. Gore would have woken some people up, right? Yeah. I mean, what more is it going to take?
But it really didn't. I mean, you didn't hear John Kerry in 2004 talk about the Supreme Court at all,
right?
Even though we had Bush v. Gore. You heard Barack Obama he doesn't talk about it at all, and he's a constitutional law professor.
Yeah.
I mean, it's shocking. Obama talked about Citizens United once in the State of the Union speech, and then he's only talked about the court in response to health care, even though they've made all these terrible decisions on corporate power and other issues since John Roberts took over. And so, really, it's just not been a priority for Democratic candidates. It hasn't been a priority for progressive groups. There's the Alliance for Justice, which is the coalition of progressive groups working on judicial issues. There's obviously groups like People for the American Way that have been around for a long time. I think either it's time for some sort of new group or some of the existing groups need to get more resources because right now, everyone seems to be opposed to the Citizens United decision, but I don't see a lot of people saying that, you know what, the quickest way to overturn that decision or to at least soften the rough edges of it is to change the Supreme Court. A constitutional amendment is going to take forever. It probably is never going to happen. If you want to get rid of that decision, you've got to change the court. That's really the only avenue that I think is going to work here.
I still cannot figure out. I mean, I certainly am predisposed to all things legal, but it's been just a mystery to me as to why this doesn't catch on. I mean, why there isn't more sort of understanding of the implications of the courts to the left. I mean, short of Roe v. Wade, there is not, you know, and now Citizens United, I guess, and maybe that's what it takes. You need to have a couple of big sort of landmark cases that people can sort of rally around and digest easily. It has been shocking to me, Barack Obama's failure on this end has been also one of those sort of just one more thing. But, you know, the bottom line is you put it right here in your piece. You've got Ginsburg at age 79, reputedly not in the best of health. I think, dealt with cancer in the past. Scalia at 76, Kennedy at 75, Breyer at 73. I think he's had a bout of cancer or something like that. I'm not sure, but we could see anywhere. It seems highly unlikely that over the next 4 or 5 years we're not going to see at least one Supreme Court justice replaced. It's quite possible it could be 3 or 4.
One is likely, and two would be very, very significant. I mean, the likelihood of two justices retiring means that you could almost certainly tip the balance of power on the court no matter who wins. And I do think, you know, despite all the, in many cases, legitimate progressive criticisms of Obama, I do think it's important to remember that Elena Kagan is still very different than John Roberts in terms of how she would have ruled on Citizens United or something else. And Pam Carlin, who you mentioned earlier from Stanford Law, she basically told me that there would be very little, she said no overlap between the people Obama would appoint and the people Romney would appoint. I would say there's probably a little overlap, but there's very little overlap. And so this is really an area, the court, where there is, I think, a big difference between an Obama administration and a Romney administration. And the prospect of the Supreme Court going 6-3 conservative under Romney, that is really, really scary when you look at all the hot button issues
Why are we? I've made the same argument in the past, but I mean, you make it. Why is 6-3 any different than 5-4?
Because I think Kennedy is still a swing vote on some issues, despite the fact that he's very conservative. Kennedy has expressed at various times an openness to gay rights, for example. So on gay marriage, there's a chance that he could rule in a progressive direction. If it's a 6-3 court, it's going to be a 5-vote conservatives on every single issue, which means that, you know, no matter what's coming before the court, the conservatives are going to win. Whereas now there's still an element of doubt here on a lot of cases, and the court still in certain circumstances takes these positions. It would also embolden John Roberts to be as conservative as he wants, knowing he doesn't have to do any negotiating, knowing that he always has 5 people, so the court could be even more active, conservative and activist in orientation than it was earlier. So I really do think a 6-3 court would give us a conservative court probably for the next 40 years.
Let me add a couple more reasons to that. Aside from the fact that sixth conservative who's appointed is going to be a 55-year-old and is going to be on the court for another 30 years or 25 years or 20 years, whatever it is, but the makeup of the Supreme Court also dictates the filing of suits, it seems to me, that there is a strategy where, you know, in terms of both timing and where you bring cases we are starting to see more and more challenges to Roe v. Wade coming out of the states because they think there's an opportunity that maybe over the next 18 months, maybe over the next 36 months, there's going to be a 6-3 majority maybe to overturn Roe v. Wade. And so it also implicates what cases go to the Supreme Court, what cases are attempted to be brought to the Supreme Court, as well as the dynamic on the court itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, conservative legal plaintiffs at the lower level, they're going to try to fast-track everything to the Supreme Court. If it's 6-3, they're already fast-tracking a lot of things when it's 5-4, but there still is a bit of skittishness about Justice Kennedy among some conservatives. If Kennedy is no longer the swing vote, then you're right. Everything is going to come before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's going to hear even more hot-button issues than they will before, and John Roberts will be less of that quote-unquote umpire and much more of the conservative activist that he was before he became a judge, and that to some extent he's been on the court already. And so I do think that a 6-3 court would have a lot of serious ramifications that I think a lot of voters haven't thought through yet.
Yeah, I mean, I get so frustrated.
Including a lot of people that have criticisms of Obama. I mean, I do think there's any number of reasons to have criticisms of Obama, but I also think you have to say to yourself, what would a 6-3 conservative court be like versus a 5-4 moderate court?
I'll tell you right now, if the court was 6-3 liberals to conservatives, I would have a very hard time of voting for Obama. I mean, it's such a hypothetical that it's one I don't necessarily have to address, but this issue in and of itself to me is reason enough to pick that lesser of two evils, frankly. But what's even more important, I think, is that there is a greater understanding amongst liberals and leftists in this country of the importance of the Supreme Court, and I think that's only coming in the wake of Citizens United to the extent that it is, and it needs to be more.
Yeah, and I think, unfortunately, that's going to happen more if healthcare is struck down rather than it's upheld. If healthcare is upheld, you're going to see a lot of liberal groups praise the court, and then they're going to forget about all the other bad things,
right,
to some extent the court's done. And so I'm not saying I'd like healthcare to be overturned. I mean, sorry, I don't know if I necessarily want to be overturned versus kept. I still think the law is better there than not being there. But I do think there's a worry that if the court upholds healthcare, a lot of liberals are going to be more deferential to the court than they should be.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not quite sure where I stand on this, but it would be interesting to see the mandate struck down and the bill found severable. Just to watch
the problem with that is, that's an easy route to just dismantling the whole law, because no one's found a good way to actually make healthcare work without the mandate on a national level. And so I think that's probably the most likely scenario. The Supreme Court does strike down the mandate, they keep the rest of the law, and then they basically are able to kill the law as a result of that, unless the Obama administration finds a very creative solution to the problem.
Well, but how do you kill that law? I mean, what do you think? The Congress is going to overturn it? I mean, who's going to...
No, I mean, they kill it by killing the mandate, which makes it impossible to implement health care on a national level without the mandate because costs will continue to rise.
Well, there's a couple of fixes that can be done through the exchanges to mitigate the rise in the cost of that, but the fact is, this is the law. And so, you know, someone's going to have to vote against these new regulations that say pre-existing conditions, et cetera, et cetera. And that's a very tough vote to make.
But my understanding, and I'm not an expert on this, but my understanding is if you don't have a mandate, healthcare costs are going to rise for everybody else.
Correct.
And so
that's correct.
That makes it difficult to actually be able to sustain healthcare over a long period of time.
The reason why the expense goes up is because the guaranteed access, essentially, I can't be denied for pre-existing conditions. You can't put lifetime caps on me. You can't put yearly caps on me. All of those pro-consumer, essentially, all of those things that make health insurance a functional product, If you do not have a mandate, obviously, somebody can wait till they're sick and then buy the insurance. And even if you don't have those sort of the so-called freeloader issues, you also have the issue of sort of you need to expand and sort of and push down the risk pool. You need to expand the risk pool and mitigate the risk. Otherwise, you're just going to have basically sick people in there and you're going to be paying out. And so, but the fact of the matter is, there's no remedy for that. You can't, it's not that the costs will explode in that situation, but there has to be a remedy for it. And who's gonna choose the remedy of let's get rid of that guaranteed access? That's a very tough vote for anybody to make.
Yeah, yeah. But I'd be surprised if the court would go ahead and invalidate the law, though certainly after the questioning, you can't take anything for granted. But I think the sort of whole reason I wrote my article was to say, no matter what happens with right. healthcare, the court is really important. We should pay a lot more attention to all these other issues that are coming before the court and all the other rulings the court has already made, which I didn't really have space in my article, but there's been a lot of consequential decisions relating to the rights of corporations beyond Citizens United that the court has chosen that are very controversial as well.
Ari Berman, as always,
have fun in Vegas.
A pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for checking in with us.
See you later. Bye.
Bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a brief break here. And when we come back, I'm going to welcome to the program Attorney James Coffin. He is with the Levin Papantonio firm, securities lawyer. Is that fair to say? He'll tell us why the Jobs Act is so bad right after this. All right, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report, and with me now in at the live from the Mass Torts Conference is Attorney James Coffman from Levin Papantonio. This is Mike Papantonio's firm.
That's correct.
And you're a securities attorney, and so all right, tell us. I've talked about the Jobs Act a little bit on this program. It has been signed into law, I think, about a week and a half ago.
Yeah, about 2 weeks ago.
And tell us what it is and why it's so bad. I mean, jobs, that's good.
Well, you would think that jobs would be good. And what it's supposed to do is jumpstart our business startups. It's supposed to allow small companies to be able to raise capital. Unfortunately...
Now, first off, let me just start with this.
Okay.
The fact of the matter is that small businesses, we love to hear about how they're the central job creators, but no, they're not.
Not really.
Okay,
no.
They're not. But let's put that aside. That doesn't mean that it would be great. I would love to be able to raise a lot of money for this program, for the Majority Report, let's say. But it's a little bit problematic because of what it does in terms of, well, you tell me.
Well, here's how... This bill came into being passed and being signed by President Obama. You know, the banks and the big banks, the Goldman Sachs, the J.P. Morgans, that sort of thing, they've typically made a lot of money off of the IPO, that's initial public offering market, when a private company gets to that point where they decide to go public and be traded. They raise a lot of money. The banks make a lot of fees off of it.
Right.
Now, that market has dried up in the last couple of years because we've had a tough economy. The jobs market is difficult. A lot of private CEOs, they don't want to take that chance of putting their company out there that it may fail. So how are we going to get them to the market? How are we going to generate some fees for Goldman Sachs? Well, what we're going to
do... Of course, that's I'll tell you, that's one of the reasons why I can't sleep at night.
That's the real agenda behind
right.
this. How are we going to generate fees for the big banks? And how we're going to do it is we got to get the companies, we got to entice them to come to the market. Well, how are we going to do that? We're going to go ahead and we're going to remove the accounting controls, the requirement that they have any internal accounting controls and that they have an independent audit. We're going to remove that for 5 years. We're going to give them a pass for 5 years and allow them to cook their books and do whatever they want to do internally, and there's going to be no oversight to it.
All right, so in other words, if I'm going to go public with the majority report, as of 2 weeks ago, what I needed to do was to show people, this is the revenue that I have.
Right.
These are the costs that I have. These are my projections of future based upon the reality.
Not just because Sam says so, but because I've got an independent accounting firm that says this is correct.
Right. Because otherwise I could say, well, you know, we're doing great. I mean, you want a piece of this because we have millions of dollars of revenue.
Yeah.
Our costs are virtually nil. It's, a couple old MacBook Pros and an iPad. And so, and my projections based upon my revenue numbers are just, we're going to go massive.
Yeah, and it's going to be huge.
Those controls are gone.
Well, anything that would find that you're lying about what your revenues would be. If you're inflating them, if you have an accounting problem internal to your company, those controls are gone. And for somebody like me who prosecutes corporate fraud, I represent investors who lose money when a company admits that they've committed fraud and the stock drops. Those are the people that I represent. One of our first signals for that is what they call an accounting restatement. The independent accountant comes in and says, we've reviewed last quarter. You've got some problems internally. You need to fix them. You have to go back and restate and say, basically, we didn't have, let's just say, $20 million in revenue. We had $15 million in revenue. You go out and cut that by $5 million. That's the first sign to us that there's something wrong in that company, and typically that's just the first sign. Typically, it's more systemic than that. There's something going on internally to the company, but that gives us a signal.
So basically, what the Jobs Act does is it just takes the canary out of the coal mine.
Yeah, and says, exactly.
And there's no way to get a tip off. Now, first off, are you starting to look for plaintiffs who own stock in Fox News Corp?
We're always looking at things. We're always looking at investigations.
Okay, so that's the now, but no, you know, part of what I've heard supporters about this is it's going to allow small companies to sort of follow the Kickstarter model, which is this sort of crowdsourcing, which is fine, but it doesn't offer. Is there also sort of like protections for investors, requirements on investors that you have a certain amount of capital or certain?
Yeah. Well, there's this qualified investor rule, which says that, you know, you have to have a certain amount of assets. It's typically $1 million, or that you make a certain amount per year. It's typically $200,000 per year. And you can be an unqualified investor. And the reason that the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, passes these types of rules is because growing companies are inherently risky. I mean, when you're investing in something that's a startup, it's very difficult because they don't have a long track record. They don't typically, have a lot of they're typically in a new field sometimes.
Right.
So there's not a whole lot of testing the waters there.
That's sort of a tough call for me on some level because, one, you know, why should these opportunities to make this money be available to a limited subset of people on one hand? On the other hand, there needs to be protections for people from sort of basically getting in over their head getting their shirts.
Well, I mean, we're in a casino right now. We're at the Wynn.
Right.
And Steve Case, who was one of the advisors to Obama on this bill, Steve Case from AOL, he had his own accounting issues when he was at AOL and was a subject of an accounting probe while he was at AOL. Steve Case said, well, you don't have to be a qualified gambler to come to a casino and place a bet.
That's right.
That's the thing. But the problem here is that it's completely missing the point. You know, first off, comparing the market to a casino, you know, frankly, is a little bit of a stretch in my mind. I would like to not think of our market as just a gamble.
Right.
I'd like to think that it has some controls. And that's the whole difference between these two. A casino actually has rules. They actually have some things built in to protect the bettor. If the games have
rules. At the very least, there's full disclosure.
Exactly.
That's the point.
You know
up front. I can go and I can look at the odds of what the blackjack are. I have my little laminated card that I don't whip out at the table because you're not allowed to, and it's a little bit embarrassing. But at least I know these are the rules. They can't at one point.
They can't change it all of a sudden and say, no, you don't have blackjack this time because I say so.
Right. Or simply they're like, oh, yeah, we didn't tell you guys, but the dealer can actually look at his hand, and it's not. They'll still sometimes hit if they or they'll back off at one point. And so that's basically the difference here is that, at least on the I guess on the disclosure side by the IPO, not necessarily on the side of the protecting the investor, but removing both of those ends of the spectrum make it that much more problematic. All right, so as a securities fraud attorney, are you just basically sitting back now and just going to wait? But there's no grounds, now?
It's very difficult. I mean, there's a couple of things that we can do to combat this. There are still rules that you can't lie in your prospectus when you do an IPO. So if you say something that's a misstatement in your prospectus, we can still come after the company for that. Our problem's going to be, frankly, the prospectus is going to say one thing and the CEO is going to say another. So the CEO is going to say something, and most investors, they get the prospectus in the mail. It is thick. It's loaded with all kinds of information.
Uh-huh.
They don't know where to look for, like, the absolute key things, the risk factors, things that they should be looking at.
But they're going to watch the YouTube.
But they're going to watch
YouTube of him on CNBC saying, we're anticipating $150 million worth of growth this year, and that's basically it. And there's not going to be – in that type of situation – I presume when someone invests in that company, there's going to be some type of release that the company is going to draw up saying, everything's in our prospectus. If you're basing it on anything else, you can't hold us responsible.
Well, that's essentially what they do. That's essentially what they're going to be able to do is they're going to just say, you know, the only way you can get them is if you find something in the prospectus that is material and misleading and fraudulent. And, you know, we still have that protection, but frankly, there's not going to be anything to keep a CEO from saying whatever he wants.
Right.
And even if it's a lie,
and there's
can't really
less
call
opportunity
it out
for recourse from the perspective of someone who protects plaintiff's rights in this situation because the law's just been blown out of the water.
Yeah, and it's really frustrating. And I think that the Securities Exchange Commission and also their role of regulating these markets, I think that they're looking at this bill and just saying, you have just created a big mess for us. I mean, this is going to be very difficult to for the SEC to get its job done, which is to, you know, make sure that the markets are trading efficiently and that there's not fraud in the market. And this act just made it much more difficult.
Now, did this change those laws for all companies, for all IPOs,
well,
or just in a certain dollar parameters?
Well, they only apply to what they call emerging growth companies. And what that means, and it is a pretty wide net, let's be honest about this, but it is any company that has revenues under $1
billion.
$1 billion, with a B. So I'll give you a for instance. Earlier this month,
that's almost upside down, isn't it? I mean, if you have a company that has $1 billion worth of revenue, it seems to me it's far. I mean, I guess there's still room for fraud in terms of there, but it's not quite as risky as a company that has $1 million worth of revenue or $10 million worth.
Right.
Of
right. Yeah. Well, I mean, and the revenue numbers that we're basing it on are...
We don't know.
We don't know, is the thing. That's the other scary point of this. You know, a company that just had an accounting restatement earlier this month was Groupon. Groupon hit the market in November.
And we should just tell people, if you're not familiar with what Groupon is, it's an online, basically, sort of crowd...
They do like daily
coupons.
Deals.
Yeah,
okay. Coupons at different, you know, restaurants and services and that sort of thing. And they went public in November. And we found out, and it's just been released on the market. There's been several lawsuits filed against Groupon following this. But they disclosed in earlier this month that their independent accountant said that their internal controls are insufficient. Or inadequate.
Right.
That's the first signal that, okay, Groupon's not accounting. There's something going on at Groupon.
Right. The first thing you hear is that the processes are a little hinky.
Yeah.
And you haven't heard quite yet that the product in terms of the product of the accounting processes are hinky, but you've heard that the
Yeah, so their revenue was inflated. They had to restate earnings.
Uh-huh.
So that tells us, and furthermore, it's how are they accounting for things at Groupon? When they, you know, when someone buys a Groupon, there's a passage of the money between the person purchasing it and the business who redeems the Groupon, and there's some accounting rules for when you can record the revenue and the timing and everything.
Okay.
And there are some issues there, it looks like. On that news, Groupon's stock dropped 30% that same day. That disclosure, now in all disclosure, Groupon makes just over $1 billion a year.
Uh-huh.
And supposedly. Maybe we don't know. But so they would still have the independent accounting, but if they were just slightly smaller, Groupon, we would have never known. And then investors would continue. They would continue to account for this, take on more debt, and then where that leads is that eventually they would probably go bankrupt.
Wow. Well, so what would you tell those people in my audience that now feel like, okay, I've got a great opportunity to invest in some IPOs?
I would say don't believe the hype necessarily. Do your due diligence if you can.
In other words, if you're a forensic auditor, then you should have confidence when you invest. Otherwise,
yeah, I mean, the biggest question is, are the brokers going to be recommending these stocks? Because if your broker turns around and says, hey, I got this great IPO, is he telling you, oh, and by the way, they don't have to have any accounting controls? What happens when your broker, because they're going to get pressure
James,
from the banks.
I am so surprised that you're so cynical about brokers. I think there's one thing that we've learned over the years is that you can trust a stockbroker with your
with
life
everything.
Savings,
That's
with
right.
everything. And there's no reason to believe that they ever act in their best interest as opposed to their clients.
That's right. That's right. Well, when the broker starts pushing these securities onto their investor, the question is going to be, is the broker really disclosing that, you know, well, we think that these are the accounting numbers, but we're not exactly sure.
Let me ask you just a general question. The regulations that are set up by the government are essentially the lifeblood and the leverage that you get in civil procedure. Isn't that correct?
That's right. That's right. And what this repeals is a provision from Sarbanes-Oxley, which required this independent audit in 2002,
uh-huh.
came out of the Enron accounting scandal. Enron happened. We said, as a government, we said, we don't want this to happen again. We're going to put this control in place, and it's going to allow, under Sarbanes-Oxley, it's kind of your hook, so to speak, for how you get these companies on the hook when they commit corporate fraud.
Well, James Kaufman from Levin Papantonio, thank you so much for joining me and warning me, and in the event that I do well here at the win, I will make sure that I am careful on how I invest that money.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Thanks
Sam.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to head to the better half of the program. I got a couple of stories here on the Supreme Court came up today in our conversation. Supreme Court, remember how corporations are just like people? Well, they're not so much when they've committed torture and you want to sue them for it. In those instances, they're not anything like people, and they can't be sued. An interesting story that more evidence that Obama, during the transition, the idea of prosecuting the former Bush officials for things like torture and war crimes was essentially stymied because of fears that Obama had regarding literally a revolt by some of the establishment. Also on the program, the Work Act. We've been talking about this in the better half of the program. We had a caller, I think it was just the other day, it must have been Monday or Tuesday, saying that they thought that the Democrats were not doing a good job at exploiting Hillary Rosen's comments relative to Ann Romney and the fact that she never worked. Well, the Democrats have done exactly what I would have suggested, which is proposed legislation. Stop trying to prove that Hillary Rosen was right or wrong, but actually move on that as a political issue. We'll talk about that in the better half of the program. Also, Tom Friedman, just days after his award as the his winning the greatest wanker of the decade from Atrios, comes out and says, I'm going for two decades in a row, with his latest piece in the New York Times. Ladies and gentlemen, it is your support which makes it possible for me to lose thousands of dollars here in Las Vegas and to keep this program continuing. So please, if you can become a member at majority.fm, please do. We need your support to continue this program. It is really our only, maybe 96% of our revenue comes from members. So the other part is mixed up between justcoffee.coop, where you can get coffee, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. And you can also buy junk through our Amazon link. Those two things make up about 3%, and then 2% is my gambling winnings, and then, of course, the rest is your becoming a member. So please do. Tomorrow on the program, Cliff Schechter will be here and more. Hopefully we'll have a couple other guests for you, too. But now let's head into the better half of the program. You can call me at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number, and we'll be right back in just a moment.
Retake one. La poupée qu'il fait longue.